Nicholas Soames and Peter Watts, welcome to the book show.
Thank you very much.
Very nice to be here.
Nicholas, first to you, Tolstoy's War and Peace. This is a case where size really does matter. In fact, the sheer scale of this unabridged recording is quite intimidating, even for the most devoted consumer of audiobooks. I know it's not been released yet, but how many discs do you think this will run to?
We think it'll run to about 56 CDs. We're going to release it in two volumes. 25 CDs will take basically sections 1 to 8, and then 9 to 15 will be about 26 CDs. That's just being finalised at the moment. It is quite a big Leviathan, this, as you say. Just for your interest, there are 565,000 words, plus a few for the Alexandrovich and all that, the patronymics. And it took about 21 days to record and about the same number to edit.
How many hours of tape time is that?
We think that'll run to about 75 hours.
Well, I mean, putting that in context, I was looking at the size of things like Beethoven's complete piano sonatas. That peaks at about 9 discs. Haydn's piano sonatas in their entirety beats that at about 10 CDs. Wagner's Ring Cycle, all 16 hours, comes out at about 12 CDs. But this is in another league. So, I mean, considering that War and Peace has always been a bit symbolic of unrestrained literary ambition, if you say that somebody's writing their War and Peace, you're not necessarily paying them a compliment. It does beg the question, is there something of a literary folly about this undertaking for Naxos?
Well, I don't think so. This really began about 3 years ago at the time of the Bloomsday centenary for Joyce, because we decided that we would then do unabridged Ulysses. Mm. And one could say then, and many people did say, that that was a complete folly. And that came out at 22 CDs. And it was remarkably popular. And we had the sales went very well, but also we had many accolades. People were very, very nice about it from right across the world. And that gave us heart to endeavour to do more of these big novels. The 19th century, there was, of course, a lot more time on people's hands, and also there weren't very many effective editors. Whereas now, an editor in a publishing house would say, hang on a second, let's just review this plot structure. But nobody said that to Tolstoy as he slaved away for 6 years. So we felt, although it was a big mountain worth climbing, it really needed to be climbed.
Well, Peter, I have to admit to people that I've in fact worked with you in the distant past on spoken word recordings, quite complex soundscapes for language tuition tapes, but they were very discreet and relatively short pieces. What you've just completed is a very straight reading, a single voice over a long period. How different is that? I mean, how hard is that to actually keep as an even output?
Yeah, well, I must say it was a daunting idea, and I don't think any of us actually had any idea how it would go. You know, an estimate made of the recording time, which we tried our best to stick to, but the pile of scripts on the desk on the first day was the most daunting. It was literally 18 inches high, and we thought, my goodness, how are we going to get through this? And we had a certain kind of word count per day. But it's a book with its own complexities of language. I mean, there are lots of Russian names for the actor to pronounce. There's lots of French, obviously. And we gradually got through it, but a couple of days over, as Nicholas will tell you, and things, obviously, you know, with such a project, the budgetary consideration is a very important one. So there's quite a lot of pressure. But I think it was a challenge that we all wanted to rise to. You know, if you're going to do a book at all, War and Peace is the one to want to have under your belt.
Well, the reader, Neville Jason, I think you described him to me as a reading machine. But even he, over that period of time, being able to maintain an evenness from beginning to end, that requires, you know, a huge amount of work. I mean, just in producing the reader themselves and keeping them at a manageable pace. How hard was that?
Well, I think it was very difficult for him because there are so many characters and they have to be consistent in the performance. And Nicholas has done lots of work with Neville over the years and will be able to tell you, having worked on the Proust, you know, That's another considerable task. I think somebody like Neville, they have tremendous stamina. It is amazing, you know, that at the end of, on our long days, which were anything up to 9 hours, I was amazed that Neville could keep going, you know, and keep the energy up. I think we worked on a schedule, really, that was 2 days on and a day off. Because the other thing from the reader's point of view, because the absolute must is preparation, you know. And, in fact, Neville likes to read it aloud to himself in preparation. But you imagine, with War and Peace, that really isn't possible. You know, there just isn't enough time for him to have a read-through. So on a couple of days, he felt he wasn't prepared enough. I mean, but for us, you know, he still did a fantastic job. And I think for a reader to make sense from the page all the time, you inevitably find your eye going ahead, you know, and I think they have to employ all the tricks of their trade to keep up the standard on such a project.
I mean, the other added difficulty, Peter, with a single voice is, as a listener, one becomes hyper-aware of the recording environment. Getting the room, the ambience right is sort of, I'd think, critical. And if you expect someone to stay with the story and not be distracted by the recording, or at least the mechanics of the recording, what's involved in actually getting that environment so that the listener can just relax into it?
Recordings of this length, which I have never tackled anything quite like this. First of all, obviously, you want to get the actor to be settled and comfortable so that they can perform. And I think then you want a kind of natural ambience. So for the listener, there's not some peculiar acoustic that's going to disturb matters. And then, obviously, you don't want to electronically interfere with the voice and have too much processing on the voice so that it's compressed or gated, or there's something unnatural happening, you know, because I think it's very important in communication to have breaths and to have a natural feel to it, so as you would in a conversation, and then I think the listener can relax into it and get the full benefit of the subtlety of what the reader's trying to get across.
Well, Nicholas, let's talk a bit more broadly about the world of audiobooks. They used to seem slightly remedial, but they seem to be coming into their own. Why do you think that is?
That's a wonderful expression, remedial. Yes, that's because, of course, they were abridged, really, till the pip squeaked. I think it's a number of issues. One of them is actually technical. Of course, in the old days, you had LPs, and so to sit down to a 75 hours of listening to an LP is very difficult and unpleasant even, because there are just loads and loads of LPs. With CDs, of course, it's different, and with downloads and with the iPod generation, of course, it's different again. So, in a funny way, the nature of the reading hasn't changed. You have someone like Neville doing War and Peace, or before that, the Proust, because we did an abridged version of the Proust, but it still went to 39 CDs, or 36 CDs, and then A Life of Proust. And Neville is a real storyteller. He inhabits the aristocratic world, which is the Proust, or which is the War and Peace, extremely naturally. And yet the bottom line is that he gets in touch with the humanness of the situation. And the problem about the very, as you say, the remedial, the serious abridgments, is that actually all you get is the story, and you don't really get the emotions that are involved. And so I think this is one reason why, as we move towards a much broader use of MP3 and CDs as well, you have a greater possibility of enjoying a longer recording, and people also getting more sophisticated in the listening to audiobooks. I think that one of the great advantages of the audiobook, of course, is that you can listen to it on the move, in your car, when you're travelling to work, when you're running, as I do, and when you're or on your bike. It's a wonderful accompaniment, and people are beginning to accept it is fine to do that. You don't have to say, oh, no, I'm sorry, I didn't read it, but I did listen to it on audiobook, which is one of the very old stigmas attached to audiobooks.
But we have had CDs around for a long time. What's suddenly changed that there's this, you know, quite dramatic uptake in the last few years? I mean, culturally, something's shifting.
Yes, actually, funnily enough, that's something to do with the end user, the people who are audiobook fans already. And that's because they became very attached to the cassette. Now, whatever one thinks of the cassette, and I'm sure Peter, as an engineer, thinks, oh, cassette, terrible sound, a lot of hiss, you know. But it was very practical. You didn't jog as the early CDs did in a Walkman, and you could stop and start at all times. So from the convenience point, it was very useful. And CDs had a little time in catching up with that, in this business of stopping and starting at the place where you left off. So that's a major reason, I think, why the interest in audiobooks is really beginning to expand now as CD settles. A lot of people think they ditched cassettes a long time ago, and the only thing that's kept the cassette manufacturers alive has been audiobooks.
But is there a new market that's opened up? Is there a market of people that realise that they can actually dovetail with their busy lives in a way that they hadn't imagined they could, and it makes them feel at least like they're in touch with the literary world?
Yes, I think that's basically, this is very true, that this multi-use that you can be driving and you can be listening. Also, maybe it's something to do with, and I'm a little on difficult ground here because I know what's happened in British radio, that there are fewer opportunities for listening to stories or longer sections of drama on public radio, i.e. the BBC, than there used to be. And so people can now feed their interest with audiobooks. And I have to say also that with classics, people are beginning to realise that they want to have their audiobooks for the family, and they can listen to it and then they can pass it on. Whereas in the old days, if you listened to Bleak House on the radio, that was it. There was no possibility of going back to it.
You said earlier about the launch of the unabridged Ulysses around Bloomsday, and that there was a market sort of demand for that, or at least it proved to be a market success. Where are you getting that information from? Is that from booksellers or is that directly from the audience?
From both, actually. We have some wonderful emails. Actually, emails are great because people can email our website, and they did in some profusion to say how much they've enjoyed it, because take us for something like Ulysses. The subtleties of the writing of Joyce extend to the fact that there are many different Irish accents which don't actually come across off the page unless you're an indigenous Irishman. But a skilled reader like Jim Norton, he can really say that one came from County Cork, another came from Kilkenny or whatever, and this really comes across. So that's one of the richnesses and one of the great advantages of actually listening to a book on audiobook.
Well, I mean, another perfect example and more extreme example, one of my favourites is Jim Norton's reading of Finnegan's Wake, which is notoriously difficult work on the page. It suddenly makes sense when you hear it read with his beautiful reading voice, that beautiful Irish lilt, and suddenly the text takes on the quality of music. And in a way, you have to believe that Joyce meant it to be read out loud. So in a sense, you wonder whether you're actually enlivening a work that was never meant to sit static on the page.
Yes, I absolutely agree with you. In fact, I feel that it's a little bit of both, that to get the most out of Finnegan's Wake, and goodness me, it's a Himalayan range all on its own, is to have the advantage of being able to read and listen. And that's why, with our abridgment, because we have yet to undertake the task of doing it unabridged, I must say it is a really extraordinary challenge. And Jim has said that he will do it. I mean, Jim, I have to say, like Neville, you know, they're both approaching their seventh decade, although you'd never imagine it from their voice and from the huge energy and marathon capabilities of their reading talent, that Jim is said that if to do an unabridged Finnegan's Wake, we have to plan over a year or so or more, because he can only do 4 days or so or 5 days, and then he really needs a couple of weeks to go back and re-study what he's going to read, because he really, like Neville, he simply will not read something that he doesn't understand, you know, which some readers, to be quite honest, do.
Which is quite an achievement with the Wake.
It's quite an achievement of the Wake, yes. Well, some of the jokes are visual, and some of the jokes are oral, and some of the jokes, of course, are both, and that's why it's so wonderful to read and listen.
Peter, tell me in that situation how important it is in the making to have the right voice, because these things are very dependent on the convincing time that the listener spends with that voice.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, but I think this preparation thing is the key, because every moment spent getting ready for this is the key thing. You know, you just can't come in and wing it, basically. When you're trying to make sense. I mean, I've listened to some audiobooks, and especially when they're badly abridged, and this just doesn't make, you know, I'm listening and thinking, well, I just don't see what people are getting out of this, you know. And it's a pleasure to be with people like Neville, who suddenly bring the whole thing alive. And I think, you know, Nicholas's choosing of the right people is absolutely the key element.
I must say, if I may come in, that thank you, Peter. In many ways, it is a key decision to make who reads. With Neville, I must say, his talent for reading was spotted by Sir John Gielgud. When Neville was at the Royal Academy, it was Sir John Gielgud who actually gave him the Reader's Award of the time. So Neville was only a young, you know, strapping lad at the time.
A little studio aside for you there. Sir John Gielgud loomed very large in the studio, because the other person of the three of us who were helping record War and Peace was John Theocaris, who used to work for BBC Radio 4, and who also had worked with John Gielgud quite a bit. So every now and then, when things went off the rails, we said, what would Sir John think? And there'd be a little conversation about pronunciation or whatever. So he loomed very large in the recording.
Well, you're listening to The Book Show on ABC Radio National and the web, and we're talking audiobooks. I'm speaking to Nicholas Soames, who's the head of Naxos Audiobooks in London, and London-based sound engineer Peter Watts, who is responsible for the epic production of the unabridged War and Peace, which is due for release later this year. Nicholas Soames, let me just talk to you again. You were speaking earlier about the way people consume audiobooks, the fact that, you know, particularly a long journey in a car is a great space, partly because it's a good use of time, but also because it's quite a meditative space to be in. And I'm just wondering whether it makes you very receptive to the act of storytelling, whether we're rediscovering that we like being read to.
I think that's an absolutely key view of audiobooks. Actually, tomorrow I start a 5-day record over a little space of time of the unabridged Odyssey with Anton Lesser. He's just done the unabridged Iliad. And of course, Homer, he read it, or he sang it. Or he certainly spoke it. No, certainly, you know, his original audience, if he ever existed, he didn't read it off the page. And it was as true of Dickens. Most of Dickens' novels were actually, you'd have one person reading, and a lot of people would be sitting round in those long Victoria winter evenings, particularly when the fog was around, listening to someone read the wonderful stories of Dickens. So it's absolutely true. And there's another aspect. First of all, I mean, of course, from children, we know how wonderful it is to be read to, and it is fine to do that. You know, I can't repeat myself more often to say that one doesn't actually have to read it oneself. It's not a shame to have it read to, you know, there's a sort of child's world. The other thing about audiobooks is it didn't, the space-time in the car or on the bike, or I have to be a bit careful on the bike, of course, because you've got to be aware of cars around you, but it is the time to read the Plato that you've never read, to read an introduction to philosophy, to read the classics such as maybe Huckleberry Finn or even Alice in Wonderland, these things that you've missed as a child or in growing up, and Crime and Punishment and the Austens. This is, now we can go back to them and make the most of what time we have.
Someone recently said to me that our brains respond differently to stories that we hear and stories that we read, that we store them or process them in different parts of our brain. Do you think that's true?
Yes, I do, actually. In fact, yesterday I spent the day lying in a hammock reading Bleak House, believe it or not, under the English sun. And I think that it was a more ruminative experience than when I'm listening. When I am being spoken to, it is more I am being entertained, because also the characters are being provided presented to me in a kind of almost 3D with the greatest readers. Whereas when I'm reading, I actually, of course, I frankly, I have to do more work and I actually, as I said, I think more and I'm creating more myself. Whereas I suppose when I'm listening to, I think I'm, it's more of instant, it's an instant feely experience. I don't know if you agree with me, Peter.
Yes, I think, sadly, most of the time when I do these things, I'm having to listen and read. So I rarely get the chance to do the passive thing of just listening. But when I do, I think it's what I was saying earlier about it's the quality of the reader is so important to me, because some people can make sense of it and it appeals to me, and some people can't. And I think you're right, you do get something out of it, because the great thing about reading is the ability to scan back all the time, you know, and you're totally reliant on the voice delivering the message to you to have made sense then at that moment, and then you're on to the next thing, you know, and you can't scan back in the same way. Yeah, I really rather suspect that there are two different processes, and it's very interesting, isn't it? I mean, and we're talking about the spoken word in general and perhaps people going back to it, and of course, you know, 400-500 years ago, the nights were dark, you know, you didn't have light, it was storytelling, you know, and that was a key part of people's lives. I mean, you in Australia, you know, Dreamtime, Aboriginal, you know, I'm talking out of culture there, Michael, but I think these things are absolutely fundamental, really.
So with the experience of producing the unabridged Ulysses, the unabridged Proust, the unabridged War and Peace, do you think this is going to signal a fairly dramatic change in your catalogue? Do you think finally you're realising a tolerance out there for people to actually spend the time with these works in their entirety as they were meant to be read or heard?
I think so, Michael. I think one of the new directions that we're taking is not just in the classic material, which of course is very much our bedrock, but also in what we think are new classics. So we're now undertaking most of the big novels of Haruki Murakami, the Japanese novelist, contemporary novelist, who is a real cult. And we have now done his, we've just done Wind Up Chronicle, which is a 21 CD reading of his masterpiece by an actor called Rupert Degas. And this follows on with The Norwegian Wood that we've done, and a Wild Sheep Chase, and his short stories. And I think this we hope, bring a new audience to even to a contemporary novelist like Murakami, because he comes off the page brilliantly. I mean, the kind of Raymond Chandler world, shall we say, the Japanese Raymond Chandler world that he inhabits, or the extreme emotions of student life in the 1960s with Norwegian Wood, which of course draws its sort of Proustian touchstone from the Beatles song. He simply said, I will not allow my novels to be abridged. Of course, Jane Austen, even poor old Leo Tolstoy, he wasn't around to say, you cannot cut my wonderful masterpiece down to 4 CDs when it should be 52 CDs, you know. So I'm very happy to work with contemporary novelists who feel very strongly that their work should be presented in full.
Well, finally, with the rise of podcasts, which you hinted at earlier, this is a phenomenon that really does privilege content and substance. And certainly in radio, we're finding that the programs that are content rich are just flying off the internet. This must mean that you as an audiobook publisher are perfectly placed to take advantage of those sort of millions of people with headphones welded to their ears. Is that opening up a new audience for you?
This has been really the major, one of the major reasons why we are now pressing ahead with more unabridged novels, because it is a fact of life that it is difficult for a bookshop, however committed to our work, and we do have some very good support from bookshops all over the world, for them to have a massive set of, let's say, 25 CDs of Volume 1, War and Peace, and 26 of Volume 2 sitting on their bookshelves. You know, they'd have to extend their shops, you know. And so the likes of Audible.com or Audible.co.uk has really made a difference, that people can now download them onto their iPods. And that's why in the autumn we will be starting our own downloads service. It is another way of really accessing these recordings.
Well, Nicholas Soames and Peter Watts, I hope the predictions of a world full of people that enjoy being read to really does come true. Thank you both for joining me on The Book Show on ABC Radio National.
Thank you very much, Michael. Delighted to talk to you.
A pleasure, Michael.